This lecture goes over some basic concepts, ideas, and facts about economic growth. The definition of economic growth is the increase in the standard of living over time. And economists measure the standard of living using something called GDP per capita. That's the total value of goods and services produced in the economy divided by the number of people. So it's the average amount of goods and services that people have to enjoy in the economy each year. Now, there are other indicators that you can use to sort of confirm that that things are improving. You can look at longevity. People live much longer than they used to. Even at the beginning of the last century, around 1900, longevity was probably in the 40s. Now it's in the upper 70s. You can look at average height. People have gotten taller. You could look at transportation, how long it takes to get places. We can get places much faster than we could 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, and so on. An important fact is that most of the growth since 5000 BC has taken place in the last few hundred years. So for a long time, there was very little progress in economic growth, and then only in the past few hundred years we've seen really dramatic progress. And the progress has been accelerating, so there's probably more growth in the last 100 years than in any other comparable period. So an example that I like to use, by the way, a lot of this material is in your readings, mostly readings that I recommended for the second 2 weeks of September. This is kind of some highlights that you should look for in the readings. An example I like to use is this, the example of bags of flour. That is, in 1500, it took 3 days of work to produce the equivalent of 1 5-pound bag of flour. In the United States today, with those same 3 days of work, a person can produce the equivalent of 400 to 450 5-pound bags of flour. So we're 400 to 450 times as productive as we were in 1500. That's how much higher our standard of living is. And actually, the standard of living in 1500 was really, on average, not much better than the standard of living at the time of Christ. So there was this long period of barely perceptible economic growth. And then starting in 1500, we start to see some signs of economic growth. But it really takes off after 1800, and particularly after 1900. The next point is that growth is a compounding process. So in that sense, it's like interest. It's like compound interest. And one of the exercises we have is just to calculate how growth works, how this compounding process works. One thing that you can use to help with growth arithmetic, at least a crude approximation, is the rule of 72, which can be used to estimate doubling time. So if the standard of living increases at X percent per year, then the standard of living will double every 72 over X years. So for example, if economic growth is 2% per year, if we divide 72 by 2, we get 36, which means the standard of living would double every 36 years. And that's about where we've been recently, 2% per year. It may actually be increasing a bit. In places like China and India, it's been faster. So in China, if they're growing at 6% a year, then their standard of living is doubling every 12 years. So there's this doubling time that increases, sorry, the amount of time it takes to double decreases as the growth rate increases. So if, for example, if our growth rate were to increase from 2% to 3%, instead of having the standard of living double every 36 years, it would double every 24 years. And so we would see even more rapid progress. For a long time throughout history, let's say through around 1800, growth was so slow it was barely noticeable. But when you double the standard of living every 36 years, then it's quite noticeable. People, it's really within a generation that the standard of living doubles, and that's kind of where we're at now, or it may be doubling even faster. The next point is that growth is due partly to capital accumulation and mostly to knowledge accumulation. For the recipe economy, you think of it as accumulating more and more recipes to produce goods and services. So capital accumulation means the accumulation of equipment and buildings, and and for a long time, economists focused on that as the source of growth. Probably from about 1850 to 1950, if you'd asked economists what the growth process consisted of, they would have said, well, it consists of people deferring consumption, but instead saving and setting aside output to be used to accumulate, steel mills and factories and other capital, forms of capital. And they thought that growth was mostly that. And then starting in the 1950s, that we began to look at other sources of growth, and began to realize that most of the growth really comes from this accumulation of knowledge, not the accumulation of capital. So developing better and better recipes has been the main source of growth. In particular, growth does not come from the rich stealing from the poor. Sometimes people characterize that. Non-economists have a hard time imagining a process in which, on average, everyone gets richer. Instead, they tend to think, well, if the United States is rich, that must be because we've taken a disproportionate share of the world's resources. In fact, what we've done is found better recipes for producing goods and services. So more productive efficiency is really what produces growth, not stealing from other people. Another point about growth is we observe major differences across countries in standard of living. For example, North Korea is very poor, South Korea is rich. There's no difference in the resource base or in the cultural base of those two countries. The difference is that North Korea has suffered under a communist rule, which is not conducive to a high standard of living, and South Korea had a more liberal economy. And we see that with lots of examples of nearby communist, non-communist countries where the non-communist country is much wealthier than the communist country. East and West Germany were an example of that when East Germany was under communism. So when we observe these large differences across countries, differences in the standard of living in the poorest African countries or the poorest Latin American countries versus European countries and the United States, we say, well, what can we do about those differences? And unfortunately, there's no magic formula that people have found for lifting underdeveloped countries out of poverty. Agencies like the World Bank have been trying to do it for years with very little success. And I don't think anyone can claim to have the answers for how to produce the changes that lift countries out of poverty. My own view is that somehow three ethics have to develop in order for a country to achieve among the higher standards of living in the world. These three ethics, I call them the three ethics of growth, are a work ethic, a public service ethic, and a learning ethic. People have to believe that working helps you get ahead, and that it is better to work than not work. There are places where you don't have a work ethic, where people believe that work is beneath what somebody could do. You can imagine an aristocratic economy where a few aristocrats own the land and everyone else works for them, that work would get kind of a bad name. It would be something for only the lower status people to do. If you can maintain a work ethic so that even people who are well off still believe in work, that's a better economy. Another thing that undermines a work ethic is if if the products of your work are stolen or taken from you, rather than a fair deal offered for your labor. So, what seems to have happened in some of, in Russia is that the way to get ahead is by working for in the sort of the criminal syndicates in the country, as opposed to working in the normal businesses. So a lot of crime tends to undermine a work ethic. Closely related is this issue of a public service ethic. And the simplest point to make there is that there are some governments, many governments, where the people who hold office or the police do not think it's their job to serve the public. They think it's their job to take from the public, to take bribes, to confiscate land, and so on. So if in a country there is no public service ethic, which we in our country tend to take for granted, we take it for granted that if you need to get a permit to start a business, let's say, you don't have to bribe the county official to get that permit. It may be a painful process to do a lot of paperwork to get that permit, but you don't actually have to literally reach into your pocket and bribe the public official just to get your paperwork processed. In a lot of other countries, bribery of the public officials is much more normal. You don't have the same level of public service ethics. And that in turn can help undermine the work ethic. If the way to get ahead in a country is to be friends with the political leaders as opposed to working hard, then that also serves to undermine the work ethic. And then the final ethic I talk about is the learning ethic, where people need to value learning. That means valuing education. That means making sure that women's rights to education are not suppressed. That means that people believe in science and they don't they aren't committed to superstitions. And finally, learning requires the ability to let failed businesses and failed ideas disappear. What happens too often is that people want to protect the old way of doing things, even if the old way is inefficient. And that impedes economy-wide learning, because learning requires change, it requires accepting new ideas, and it requires throwing out failed ideas. And one of the things that happens if you have government controlling the investment in the economy, government controlling where which businesses stay alive and which don't, government tends to be reluctant to let a failed business disappear because you lose a political constituency that way. And so you get more of this economy-wide learning if you have more of a private sector and you let failed businesses actually fail. Another characteristic of economic growth that non-economists sometimes have a hard time seeing is that we will not run out of resources, including oil. And that's because what we're developing over time is better and better recipes that use fewer resources. Along the same lines, we're not headed toward an environmental catastrophe. In the 1970s, there was a popular movement claiming that there were limits to growth and that we were going to run out of resources, and that the economy could not continue to grow, that population could not continue to grow, we were going to see people starving, and so on. In fact, the amount of food grown per acre has increased. In the United States, we've taken a lot of acreage out of agriculture, and yet we're still producing enough food for this country and also for export. By many measures, the environmental impact of our economic activity is declining. The amount of tonnage of trash produced per capita has been going down. The amount of pollution produced per capita has been going down, and so on. That is one of the characteristics of an economy where we're getting better and better recipes, is that we waste less and less. So we produce less trash, less pollution. So instead of the environmental catastrophe that was envisioned, we're actually seeing improvements in most of, in a lot of those indicators. Now, what about sort of ongoing sources of growth? Are we going to run out of ideas or recipes? And again, from that perspective, one should probably be optimistic rather than pessimistic. A main current source of growth is something called Moore's Law, which you can read about in the textbook. Moore's Law says that we seem to be able to double the capacity of computers about every 18 months or so, which is really remarkable. For the economy as a whole, we think it's a great doubling time if we can double every 36 years. But for computers, it's more like every 18 months. And Moore's Law is a powerful source of economic growth. It's maybe adding almost a percentage point to our overall economic growth in the last 10 years, and will probably continue to add quite a bit to growth in the next decade. Also in the future, in addition to computer power, there's something called nanotechnology, which is the development of really small-scale chemistry and physics, so really small materials. And that's that is probably going to do things like help resolve energy problems by producing much more efficient products. It will make it much easier to manufacture just about anything. New materials are being developed that never have existed before, and so on. So nanotechnology is another future source of growth. And then finally, there's biotechnology. Biologists are discovering more and more about how biological systems work, about the human genome, and so on. And that's probably going to also cause future growth to accelerate. So one question is, if we get more, better and better at producing things, won't we run out of jobs? And if we develop, robots, or nanotechnology allows people to fabricate all sorts of things cheaply, will we run out of jobs? The economic answer to that is no, that human wants are not limited, that the human wants are unlimited. The nature of jobs certainly will change. Just what we've seen historically, for example, is that the percentage of people engaged in agriculture has gone way down. As recently as 150 years ago, probably over half of Americans were engaged in agriculture. Now it's down to about 2%. There was a time when maybe 25% of people worked actually on assembly lines or in the manufacturing sector as production workers, and now that has dropped to less than 10%. So the nature of jobs changes. People are, now are doing more service jobs, are doing more managerial jobs, more professional technical jobs, and that probably will continue to increase. But we won't run out of jobs. They'll shift from jobs that involve making things to jobs that involve services. Having said that, leisure is likely to increase. People are going to want to spend take some of their it, this increase in output per person and use that to enjoy more leisure. So we probably will see more leisure, but we will not run out of jobs. So that's a list of facts and ideas about economic growth, a lot of which are not widely understood among non-economists. So it provides a useful introduction to this economic concept of growth.